everyone. Welcome to another Your Migos podcast. Apologies for my voice. Tom and I are here with Hans Terrible Hommers. Start. We're gonna close the loop, hopefully, on adjuvant therapy and renal cancer. Talk about Keynote 564. We did an adjuvant podcast with David, brought in some melanoma data, which I think was instructive. We're going to talk about renal and then at the end move towards the bladder data with some, we think, pending survival data or other data pending that will be informative and sort of round out the field. So Hans, welcome. Briefly introduce yourself, and then I'm going to give a little summary of what was presented at ASCO GU in regards to the adjuvant pembro and renal data, and then turn it back to you to sort of talk about some of the issues around survival and some of the questions asked at the end.
Sure, sounds good. Yeah. So thank you, Brian and Tom. So I'm a professor of medicine at UT Southwestern. I focus on GU/kidney cancer. That's me.
That is you. I mean, there's more to you than that, Hans, I could tell you. Don't sell yourself short, Hans.
Relevant to this podcast. Okay. So 2 minutes on Keynote 564. This is the adjuvant pembro in high-risk resected kidney cancer, basically T2 high-grade and higher risk. About 500 patients in each arm randomized to a year of adjuvant pembro or placebo. We've seen DFS results twice before that were positive in the 0.6-ish range for disease-free survival. We had not yet seen overall survival, although the initial immature data was trending in the right direction with hazard ratios in the 0.5 range. At ASCO GU, we saw the overall survival curves, which were significantly different, hazard ratio of 0.62, with a 5.2% absolute difference at 48 months. There was not quite 5 years of follow-up in this population. About 31 more events in the placebo arm, but again, significant at a 0.002 value. We saw updated DFS curves, which not surprisingly continue to show a difference. No p-value because it had already been met. Hazard ratio is 0.72 and about an 8.3% absolute difference in recurrence at 48 months and about 50 more recurrences in the placebo arm. And then the last numbers I'll mention are the subsequent therapy. So what was shown was 161 patients with recurrence in the pembro arm, 210 in the placebo arm. About 80% received any subsequent therapy. And of the patients who got any subsequent therapy, about 80% of those received, about 50% of those received anti-PD-1 therapy. And then there was actually, and we can talk about this, over 20% in each arm who received radiation or surgery as their therapy, you know, upon documented recurrence, and about 15-ish% in each arm who did not get subsequent therapy. After the presentation, there were a number of people who came up to the microphone, Hans, including yourself, who really asked a lot about this subsequent therapy and how many got immune therapy. And Chris Ryan asked a great question of the patients who died, you know, who did or didn't get immune therapy. And a lot of that data just either wasn't available or wasn't presented. So why don't I
mean you don't think Hans's question was great as well?
No,
you know, it was great, yes. You did specifically say Chris's question was great, but you know, was there a problem with Hans?
They were all great. Okay. Anyone listening, they're all great questions. Hans, tell us, maybe re-ask the question and tell us your thoughts around the survival signal and in light of the subsequent therapy.
Sure, absolutely. So first of all, I mean, I congratulated Dr. Cherry and the team for the study and also for showing an overall survival benefit. I think that's great. I hope it's true. And I think that's where most of the questioning comes from. So what I started with was to remind everyone that there is at least one trial in melanoma, and I assume David talked about that, where the investigators were insistent that the patients on the control arm would be able to get access to PD-1 inhibition no matter where in the world they would live. And so it's important that if you study agents in the adjuvant setting, right, where really the question that we ask for long-term outcome is, if you treat patients super early versus delayed, is it more effective if you give it super early at the cost of 70% of patients who never needed therapy, 70% of the cost that you never needed, right? And so the question was, you know, 5% absolute difference at 4 years, do we think that maybe an access issue in certain parts of the world where patients really don't have insurance or cannot pay for PD-1 inhibition at the time of recurrence may have led to this survival signal? And the data that was initially presented, they kind of like changed the denominators depending on if that's systemic therapy or not. But Brian, you're absolutely correct. A little less than 50% of patients actually got subsequent PD-1 inhibition. And I think, you know, Chris Ryan pointed out, you know, probably the easiest number to look at if there is an access issue is really to ask the question of the patients who died who really got in trouble, right? Who needed systemic therapy, did they actually get access to PD-1 inhibition? By the way, the same question I asked in a different setting as the trial is being written up. And we don't have the answer yet. And I think that is an important question to ask for the field to get a better understanding since this trial wasn't designed in a way that it guaranteed access. So Hans, to get a sense of it's true or not.
And Hans, in that melanoma study, what is the result? How many patients did get it? Was it a positive OS signal? What's the impact of, you know, in that trial that you and David both have talked about? What is the end result of that trial?
Yeah, so the end result is that there's no overall survival signal. I don't remember all the numbers
head. It has been reported or has not been reported?
They have not seen, I'm not sure that they have the events.
We don't know the result of that trial yet.
I have to look that up, to be honest with you, but they have not reported an OS signal. Now, and remember, this is now more than 5 years out, right? I mean, this is now...
But we don't... Study. But the trial, you said it's the best design and stuff, but we don't know the result of that trial. And it's a very old study, so it's not a great... You know, one could argue both ways, couldn't you? I guess.
Yeah, it's a very old study, but...
We should know the result. We still don't know.
Yeah, but Tom, if I may finish... If giving immunotherapy was the smartest, if giving immunotherapy super early without knowing if somebody has cancer or not, and the postulation is this got to be so much more effective than if you give it later, then I do think we should have seen an overall survival signal, especially in a cancer that is so uniquely sensitive to immunotherapy, right? So the other backdrop, right, we should not forget, is that so far, and we can see what happens with the bladder study, so far this is the only trial that has shown OS benefit in the adjuvant setting, right? So I think that's why it's important to take a look at it, and also, you know, I mean, we should not forget there was a reason why the investigators of the KEYNOTE-054 study insisted on that particular design, because you are using agents that do have curative potential in the metastatic disease setting, right? So no matter where you used PD-1 in kidney cancer, PD-1 inhibition, it has shown typically an OS benefit, no matter where. So it should be somewhere in the treatment history of a patient to really show, to really test the question if giving it super early is going to be.
And Hans, we were all investigators in these trials. I was involved in two of them. I suspect you were involved in two or three of them. Brian, you led one of them, I believe. And at the time we designed these trials, did any of us insist on that? Is this a community issue? Or, you know, do we know of anyone who refused to take part in the trials because they felt that they weren't designed properly? Or did we all take part in good faith?
I think we all took part in good faith. But I don't have a problem, Tom, per se, with the design that is like, you know, heresy, or that it is a huge mistake or anything. I just think that, since this is a key secondary endpoint, if we elevate that to the level that to say, hey, this is now improving over survival, I do think we need to be just more careful with how we look at the data and not rubber stamp the result. I think we need to take a closer look at the data set and then see if it's really true or not. Because the truth is, it wasn't designed to look at OS, right? It was designed to look at DFS.
Well, so I think the truth is it was designed to look at OS, because it was, and in all of the trials we spent alpha on it, and there are 1,000 patient trials. So, you know, I think we did design them to look at OS.
But it's scientifically not a clean design, right? So if this was a mouse experiment?
Do we know what a scientific clean design looked like?
Well, I think, you know, if you want to ask the question of giving immunotherapy super early versus delayed, right, you need to give patient access in the delayed setting, meaning meaning so obviously clinical trials are messy, etc., but at least patients should have had access to it if you want to have a relatively clean design, right?
I think, just to chime in, I think it'd be good to know more detail around the subsequent therapy in both arms,
right?
Especially the placebo arm, obviously, because there are good reasons not to get immune therapy and there are bad reasons, right? The good reasons might be solitary lung nodule, you get SBRT and you're observed, or you have an indolent recurrence and you get observed, right? And those patients don't need immune therapy, at least not yet. And so you wouldn't think about giving, that's not a bad reason. It's just the biology of that patient's disease. Or a patient has favorable, recurs with favorable risk disease. And I don't do this, but you could argue TKI monotherapy is a standard of care. And so, okay, that's another reason to not get immune therapy. The bad reason would be access, right? A bad reason would be patient recurs with intermediate poor risk disease, should have gotten an immune-based combo, pick your favorite, but didn't, for whatever reason. And so that's it's just that extra layer of detail, Hans. I think you're saying that when we're interpreting this 5% difference, it'd be nice to know that layer of detail as to what are the good and bad reasons patients did or didn't get immune therapy. And obviously these numbers are going to go up over time, right? I mean, capturing subsequent therapy is imprecise, and all those good reasons, those patients may get immune therapy, but we don't want patients to die without getting immune therapy. That's really the crux of the issue.
Right. Totally, totally, totally agree with you, Brian. I think you captured it well. So again, I mean, I don't want to, I participate in the study, right? It's not like this is like a horrible study we should have never participated in, was heresy or anything like that. I'm not saying that at all. It's just like, when we deal with a trial that was not perfectly designed for the US, which, by the way, is a sentence I said years ago, right? This is not just because the result is there. I said years ago when DFS was there that this trial is not perfectly designed for US, but nobody remembers that. But that's another story.
To record it.
Write yourself an
email. Can we design that trial? I mean, I think that's what Tom's been asking is, let's say a trial is designed where patients give access. Single agent Pembro is not a standard of care.
Yeah, correct.
Metastatic setting. There's data, and I do it sometimes in frail patients. But if you said, is it a standard of care with a proven survival benefit? The answer is no. So you know that gets into the messy, complex nature of trials and crossover. Yeah. And what do I do with if I get access to Pembro at recurrence? What am I doing with that? What if I want to give Ipi/Nivo, et cetera? You know what I mean? So that's sort of. I'm not sure what that trial design looks like.
Hans, my take on this a little bit, and I've been spoken to Dave, and I was in Tokyo over the weekend. And I was speaking to the amazing Japanese investigators. I had a terrific time, as you can imagine, in Japan. And we had a lot around this. And what we sort of said, or the conclusion we came to, was the increased scrutiny associated with the adjuvant pembrolizumab data compared to the other data sets and compared to previously needs to be much tighter, because it now has an overall survival signal, the likelihood is many, many more patients are going to be offered therapy. And therefore, we as a group have a responsibility to double down on the data, look at it even more scrutiny. And the reason why we're pushing this one to its limits, unlike the adjuvant atezo study, is we were using adjuvant atezolizumab and it doesn't have a survival signal. And it's entirely justified to ask difficult questions. That's kind of our job. And you and others and Brian and Dave McDermott, and we should all be asking difficult questions to make sure we're doing the best things for our patients.
Yeah, that is exactly, you're speaking from my heart, Tom. You're speaking from my heart. this is exactly how I feel, right? I mean, so again, it is a significant investment, right? Not only with regards to side effects and treatment time on the patient, but also financially, right? So I mean, should the message be, let's say, to developing countries, you have to give it super early because there's an OS signal, or, save your money for patients who actually have recurrent disease, right? So I think that these are all these like complicated aspects that emanates from that. And you're absolutely correct. The reason why, this study is under the microscope simply because it was positive for an OS and one of the first, or the first trial in the adjuvant setting to have an OS signal, right? So obviously now we're going to home in on it. We want to understand it better. All the points that you and Brian have raised are terrific points. Chris Ryan's question, I think, is the easiest data set to get to it with regards to access. So that's all I want, is that as a field, we take a step back and say, hey, let's look at this data set. Let's learn as much as we can from it. It wasn't perfectly designed from my perspective, but doesn't mean it's a bad, bad design or we should scold anyone. I participated in the trial, obviously. and so that's all I'm saying.
Brian, should we move? Because there's something exciting coming up at EAU. And yes. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because we did, during David's podcast, we promised everyone we'd talk about adjuvant bladder cancer. We talked about melanoma. We talked about kidney. We said we'd talk
David,
about...
David tends to be long-winded, so we didn't...
David was long-winded, but very amusing. It's very amusing.
So we know Checkmate 274 was positive for DFS, hazard ratio around the 0.7. It was enriched in the PD-L1 population. That data has been presented at least once, maybe twice or more. We've not yet seen an overall survival signal, and that's obviously been the question. We saw at ASCO GU the ambassador data that Andrea Apollo presented with adjuvant Pembro with a similar DFS signal. The PD-1 wasn't as clear, but the overall ITT DFS signal was very similar, but without an overall survival benefit for adjuvant Pembro in that setting. And so I think at EAU coming up, we are hopeful that there will be finally the OS data from 274, which you've been berating Matt Galsky about on repeated
berating
podcasts,
is the wrong least. Word. You're missing.
I think it's
you're,
the right
that's
word,
a
actually.
Misinterpretation.
You are berating Matt Galsky, Tom.
I know.
How can you do that? I know.
He designed one of the
he's
best.
He's a saint. He's a saint.
All right. So, Tom, why don't you give us your thoughts on, well, I guess the adjuvant bladder immune therapy DFS signals that we've seen, and then what you're expecting out of OS.
One of the reasons I was keen for Hans to come is there's an issue around patient selection with ctDNA, and we've chatted about that previously, and I wanted to talk a little in the last 5 minutes about how we're gonna incorporate patient selection into the adjuvant setting. I'd like that to be where we end if we can. So the story goes a bit like this. At EAU this year, we're going to look at the OS signal. 274, it's probably got about five. I'm not taking part in the study, and there's nothing that I know that's not in public. So essentially, we know it's the abstract's there. It says the OS signal is going to be presented in about a month time at the EAU. At the same session, we also know that results for the ctDNA negative population from this prospective and Vigor 11 trial, the ones that are negative and remain negative, is going to be at the same meeting. So there's going to be a bit around a session, which I think is going to be a good session. We know that the adjuvant atezolizumab study came out first, and it showed DFS and OS signals both in the mid 0.8s. that were not statistically significant, and they obviously didn't go take any further. At the same time, as you said, you showed a DFS signal for nivolumab 7, which enriched down to 0.51 in the PD-L1 positive population, but there was no OS seen. And subsequent to that, there have been a number of meetings, and people like me have been saying, look, it's a secondary endpoint. The primary endpoint is DFS. You can always show secondary endpoints if you want to. Why not just show, even if it's not completely mature, and by the way, the minimum follow-up is now probably 4 or 5 years, even if it's not mature, show us the data. The reason it's important is we want to have that conversation with our patients, saying that we have DFS and OS is trending the right way, and therefore you can give it. Whereas if you've got no idea what the OS is like, as you know, has been said previously by Hans and others, you know, giving second line, let's say giving EV Pembro at relapse might be a whole lot better than giving adjuvant nivolumab without OS. And then patients, I mean, EV Pembro might not work well, or you can't give it after nivolumab. So that's been the debate. And then of course, Andrea Apollo did that brilliant presentation at ASCO GU where she showed an almost identical DFS signal for adjuvant pembrolizumab, no enrichment in the PD-L1 positive population. We did a whole podcast on that, and you please feel free to go back and listen. The biomarker's different, and I don't think it's fair to compare biomarkers, although PD-L1 biomarker's not been great in this space. But the OS signal came in at 0.98, which was obviously very negative, and that's created a lot of concern in the community, because now we've got two studies without OS, and then we've got a third study, which we're routinely giving as standard of care to patients. And the question is, you know, without any further information, I guess we should assume that OS signal is negative. There hasn't been a press release to suggest the nivolumab signal is positive. So that doesn't mean it's not positive. But so it's an exciting time in bladder cancer. And that data set's going to be really important.
So, Tom, let me ask you a question. Like, is OS absolutely mandatory? We like it. We like it to be clean. We like to do as big as possible, of course.
Yes.
But would you give a drug on just, let's say this 0.7, you know, 0.6, 0.7 seems to be the hazard ratios for DFS. And, you know, 8 to 10% difference in rates at 4 years for the adjuvant renal data. So is that enough? You know, we're debating the OS and getting into nuances, which is great and important, but is DFS enough, or would you say it's not enough?
Well, this is me, and I'm not but I'm not everyone, but in the bladder cancer community, it does look like DFS is enough without any indication of OS, because I think many people are offering this therapy. It's been EMA approved, but only in the PD-L1 positives. It's got an ITT label in the US, and I think it's being really widely given. And I'm not a great supporter of that. I've always said, at least I'd like to see OS trending in the right direction if it's immature, which is why I'm so keen to see the data. So I can say to my patients, not just it'll delay the time to your cancer coming back. There's only about a 50% chance you need it. And by the way, I don't know if your cancer does come back. I don't know 5 years down the line if it helps you live longer or not. And that conversation is so much easier if you can say, oh, and by the way, we've got some preliminary data which suggests that 5 years, there's a 5% reduction in the risk of death as well. Now, it's not mature yet and we're waiting longer. And once you have, it's okay not to, in my opinion, it's okay not to show all the data if it's not being widely used. You know, it'd be very reasonable for to say, look, we don't yet have that signal, and therefore we're not filing with the EMA and FDA. We're waiting till we've got that OS trend, and then we'll release it. But I think if you're giving the treatment to patients, I think that you should also be showing all the data, because the statistical robustness of the trial is not going to be compromised at this point. You know, it's only a year of therapy. Not all the patients are all going to come off therapy at this point and switch across to a different arm. So I can tell you now, the BMS people are not doing it because they don't want to. I've spoken to them a dozen times about it. They're doing it because they're saying the statisticians are really struggling to allow it because they don't interpret their protocol that way. So this isn't I don't think this is a problem that BMS are sort of hiding their data or anything. I just think they've got lost in their statistical analysis plan, and I would probably put an amendment in which to say we want to look at it now.
Hans, what do you think of that question? Is were you giving adjuvant pembro based on DFS alone, or were you waiting for OS?
I think, Brian, this is the question. I think this is an outstanding question, and I think it's an important question to actually remind ourselves, you know, like, how did we get into the adjuvant space and why are we excited, and how did we probably get to the DFS as a surrogate, right? That's really what it is. And the truth is, if you take a step back, the question we should ask ourselves is, if you were a breast cancer guy, colon cancer guy, and also remember neoadjuvant cisplatin, right? Would you give those therapies if there was no OS benefit? Probably not, to be honest with you. I mean, I don't think we would have opened up the adjuvant space that much if there wasn't, at the end of the day, a data set that suggests that patients who we did this in actually lived longer, because at the cost of all the side effects, the time invested, cost of the drugs and everything else. DFS, I think, is a... So, and then the problem was, right, then with drug development, well, essentially it's a complaint of, well, it takes so long to see an OS benefit, takes so long to do adjuvant trials. This is a major lift, right? This is like somebody does it once in their career, right? And then their career is over by the time they get the adjuvant trial. So it's a huge effort. It's a long-term thing. And what's the surrogate? The surrogate is DFS, right? But if it doesn't result in OS benefit because you're using a therapy that is as effective super early as it is later, then we have to rethink it, because there's significant cost in toxicity, significant cost to the society, and cost is going to become more and more important. And the other thing is also, I would say, the backdrop, especially with kidney cancer, I think, is that we are now going to move in the future beyond PD-1. And I think the fear that we may be actually, in fact, under-treating patients and changing the immune response constellation or milieu, if you will, with just PD-1 exposure towards the negative may actually be a real concern moving forward in the future. So I do think it is an important question, whereas to me, that is the data point that would make me persuade and say, hey, you should really take this therapy, because we have clearly shown you're going to live longer if we give it to you now versus later.
I think your points about changing the environment and how's that going to impact people down the line is obviously something we'll get into in the future as we get data, right? We have no data right now. Yeah. Tom, why don't we end with, you want to talk about ctDNA and what role you think it's going to play maybe in either disease or both moving forward.
Well, one of the themes throughout these three podcasts has been that the problem, and Hans, you've talked about this before, we chatted before, you know, because I made some parallels with other studies like 214 in the metastatic space. And at that, you know, at Checkmate 214, ipi-nivo versus sunitinib, many of those patients never got subsequent therapy. The trial didn't have the design to switch to subsequent therapy. And actually at the first analysis, only 27% of patients in the control arm got subsequent therapy. And I kind of hammered you a bit with that. And you came back to me, and which I thought about, and you said, Tom, but it's different. The stakes are very different in the metastatic space. And in the adjuvant space, we're over-treating a large proportion of patients who will never relapse. And there's not that, there's nothing in it. There's only harm in it for them. And one of our real goals at this point needs to be, you know, I think the first step of developing drugs that work is really important. We don't currently necessarily have the tools to work out in whom to treat. But the next step, even in kidney cancer, needs to be, we need to make sure those patients who are not in harm's way are not being put in harm's way, particularly if, Hans, you're correct, and we're going to give more and more active agents in this adjuvant space, because giving patients really quite active immune therapy comes at even more risk. So one of the things which is has been pursued in urothelial cancer by Roche and Natera and a number of investigators is looking at ctDNA. And we've chatted about this before, and the data that's going to be presented at the EAU looks at the negative patients. So those patients who have high-risk urothelial cancer and who are negative. And in Vigor 11, which is the protective study, we follow people for a couple of years. We check on their ctDNA at baseline. And if they are positive, or if they become positive, they can then be randomized to atezolizumab or placebo. One of the key, I think it's a really important study. We're doing lots of other neoadjuvant studies and lots of complicated studies. But the problem with almost all of the other studies is we're taking all the patients with us. And this is the first opportunity or first attempt to try and leave behind those patients who we don't think need therapy. And the question we're asking is, are we confident that we're leaving behind the right patients? How accurate is it to be ctDNA negative? And there is some uncertainty to that, because all the data so far has been a bit retrospective, or prospective and retrospective. So in Vigor 11, in Vigor 10, which was the randomized trial, the prospective study, we, you know, retrospectively went back and looked at the samples. This is the first really prospective exploration of this with sequential samples. And I hope, you know, clearly, if you're negative, we want the chances of you relapsing to be, you know, less than 30%. I'd like it to be less than 15%. In Vigor 010, it was about 30% or 25% of those patients relapsed. I feel that's too high for me. But I think that as we do it prospectively, I hope we can show it's more accurate. The Danish group showed it was more accurate. I think in a smaller study, they showed if you were negative, your chances of relapse was less than 10%. So this is going to be a really important question. And having these two presentations, the same meeting at the same time, number one, the OS signal, with all the caveats that we've been talking about for this and all the other adjuvant trials, and number two, the opportunity to try and spare those patients therapy who don't need it. It might be a really, I hope it's going to be a really important moment.
Yeah, so I you know, so Tom, this is exactly, I think, where the field needs to move. And that really means we're getting rid of adjuvant, right? That really what it means. We're going to go into the minimal residual
MRD,
disease.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so again, adjuvant, I think it's crude, it's not modern, it's something that we need to get rid of. You know, the one trial that I would love to hear your thoughts on this, since you mentioned Metgalski earlier. I think the modern trial that Metgalski and I think Stephanie Burke have devised that is, I think, open now, you know, that has really, you know, that really stratifies and utilizes ctDNA as a tool to either intensify versus de-escalate immunotherapy in that setting, I think to me is a really, really cool way thinking about this. And
can I talk about the design of that trial really quickly? So for those people who don't know, it is a beautiful study. So essentially, it's a study where patients are tested for ctDNA using Natera post high risk surgery and for bladder cancer. If you're positive, you're randomized to nivolumab plus a LAG-3 versus nivolumab alone. If you're negative, you're randomized to nivolumab alone versus placebo. I mean, the concern I have is if you're negative, you steal half the patient to getting nivolumab. I think it's an okay question, that negative question. But I think if the test is, you know, if the relapse rate in the negative patients is only 5%, or 10%, you're still giving half those patients nivolumab.
But then you'll prove that, right?
You prove that prospectively.
Then you'll prospectively prove that you shouldn't be treating
those. Yeah, but wait a second. Yeah. But wait a second. In the IMvigor011 trial, IMvigor11, we're completely sparing those negative patients. And let's say your relapse rate is only 5%, if you're ctDNA negative from the IMvigor11 trial, if it's only 5%, you know, you both said to me that you feel that that 5% delta in, you know, some people said to me in the adjuvant Pembro trial that 5% delta is modest. You're going to find it, you know, you go, if only 5% of patients relapse at 5 years, it's going to be very hard for that trial to be positive.
But it's not. Yeah, no, that's the whole point.
Yeah, that's the whole point, exactly.
You need to test it prospectively because you don't really know what those numbers are. You're speculating it's 5 or 15 or 30, but you don't really know.
But if the results of IMvigor11 come out and show those none of those ctDNA patients relapse, that would be useful information for that study because they'll need 10,000 patients to prove. You know, it'll...
Anyways, I love that design. I absolutely love the design, and I congratulate the cooperative groups, Matt Gorski and Stephanie Berger. I think this is just a beautiful trial, and I think we should do something like that in other cancers, quite frankly.
The other bit I like about that design is that I think in the positive arm, I think ctDNA clearance is a primary endpoint. And so instead of looking at radiological relapse or overall survival, now that's a really clean way, in my opinion, and quite a novel way of testing drugs. So you're now going to work out, is there LAG-3 activity? And you can find that out pretty quickly because we know that, atezolizumab is associated with about 20% ctDNA clearance. Nivolumab will probably be about the same. And if it's 40 versus 20%, you don't need 10,000 patients to prove that. You can probably do that with about 100 patients with ctDNA clearance. And then you can launch a big randomized trial off the back of that. And so we can do drug discovery very early. And drug discovery very early for immune therapy is really important because we're throwing away, in my opinion, too many drugs. Because right now we're testing our best drugs in patients who already experience and their cancers have progressed after so many therapies, including immune therapies, that I don't think testing and retesting with immune therapy is particularly active. We know that from CONTACT-3. So this actually has this really attractive piece of, and it's, you know, we tried to do it in the neoadjuvant setting. I think neoadjuvant is really hard, in my opinion. I'm not sure PATHCR is a great endpoint, although I do think...
So we're getting into like 7 other podcasts, right? Let's put a bow on this. So summary, adjuvant Pembro and renal extends survival. There's some questions around the subsequent therapy and who got what and why did or didn't people get immune therapy. But nonetheless, the signal is there and it only adds to the story, you know, of giving this drug. And we look forward to more data because it helps us take care of patients. And in bladder, we have one negative OS signal awaiting another. And I think we all agree.
Two negatives.
Some sort of biomarker. Negatives. Two negatives, excuse me. I always forget about your trial, Tom.
I have to put up this abuse week in, week out?
A biomarker-based approach, ctDNA being promising, but not the only one, is critical, right? Nobody disagrees with that. And these prospective studies are critical, right? And applaud all the investigators, you know, for doing them, because doing prospective biomarker-based studies is really hard, you know, and to the folks supporting them, so... Hans, we appreciate your time.
Hans, fabulous.
Sure, absolutely. My pleasure.
See you soon.
Awesome. Bye-bye. Thanks, all.
Okay, bye-bye.